How many of you have just spent your first night here? Last night, how many have as the first night? Okay, well, last night was my first night here too. And so I haven't had the opportunity to meet a lot of you, but I do hope that as meal times come up and so forth, that I will have that opportunity. And over at the break time at 10:30 and so forth. First, let me tell you a little bit about myself. You probably got from the schedule, my name is John Watkins. And I need to share with you that I am not a minister. And the reason I need to share the fact that I'm not a minister is not that I wouldn't want to be a minister, but as I was writing, corresponding back and forth with Holden, the secretary of the college where I teach in our department called me one day and she said, "Reverend Watkins, there is a letter for you. Would you like to come and get it, Reverend?" And so the way she was talking about using that word reverend with reference to me, it let me know that she didn't think that I fit that image very well. And so I'm telling you now that I'm not a minister, simply that so that you won't think in terms of me and ministers or judge them by me or whatever else. In teaching at Ferris, one of the things that has happened over the last several weeks is that we have been in San Francisco, and the college has provided me a way to get back to provide a workshop in San Francisco on communication and human relations. And one of the neatest things happened during that time. My family's been traveling with me, and we went from San Francisco up through Corvallis, Oregon, and then on up here. And in Corvallis, when we stopped there, one thing that was really very nice about it was that that was my very first teaching experience. I taught at Oregon State, and we sort of did a pilgrimage to go up to the campus and see all the changes that have been made since that very first time that I taught there. And we walked into the building where I taught before. And I sort of went through my old office and all of that, and it suddenly dawned on me that I was now observing this next year, my 25th year of teaching. It was my, you know, silver anniversary coming up. And I hadn't even thought about that. And talk about a moment of truth, I thought, gee, 25 years, what am I going to be doing over the next 25 years? And I realized at that point that I'd be doing basically the same kinds of things that I'm doing right now, but hopefully I'd be doing them about 25 years better. Before I really get underway, I want to share with you several observations. The first one is that there is a statement that a man by the name of Fritz Perls makes. I don't know how many of you have heard of Perls before. He's a Gestalt psychologist. How many of you have? All right, a number of you have. He makes a comment that he says, "I am my own laboratory of life." And I like that comment very much, because what he's saying with that to me is that for me, from my point of view, the only way I can understand anything is based on how I've experienced it. And for that reason, I'm going to be sharing a lot of personal experiences with you over the next several days. Because the only thing I know about human relationships, the only things I understand about communication are the things that I've really experienced myself. So I'm going to be sharing that a lot. A lot of personal experiences. I have to let you know ahead of time that a warning that I give to my students. You have the opportunity here to learn a lot about John Watkins or a lot about communication. And so I'm going to be giving these as sort of parables, and I hope you can separate the stories about John Watkins from the story from the actual points about communication I'm going to be making. Second thing, how many of you are acquainted with Viktor Frankl? Anybody? All right, again, a few hands go up. Viktor Frankl is a therapist, or a logotherapist. He's written a book called The Doctor and the Soul. And at the end of that book, he says that anybody who talks about two fields has to realize that he's walking the frontier of two territories, and he's being watched from both sides. And so if any of you are in psychology or therapy or mental health or whatever, I know you're going to be sort of watching me from that point of view. Those of you in communication are going to be watching me from that point of view. But there's one nice thing about it. If there's anything that that I say in one area that brings the questions in your mind, I may retreat into communication if it's been on therapy or whatever. I'll retreat back and forth. You'll notice I have a lot of equipment up here. I got the slides. I got the tape recorder here. That's going to restrict me a little bit, but a question was asked a little while ago, where did I come up with the title of It Ain't Healthy to Be Normal? And I didn't answer that question at that time, and I'm about to do some answering on it. But to do that, I have to go back to a place in my background many, many years ago, to eastern Montana, a little town called Sydney. When I was back in time, a junior, or probably about a sophomore or junior in high school, and I fell in love with that gal there. She was the neatest thing that I had ever seen in my entire life. And for over a period of years, I, you know, how high school infatuations go and so forth. The only problem that was involved there was the fact that she couldn't see me for beans. I was just the fat little kid that played the tuba in the band. And so she didn't have any interest at all in me. Now, I maintained that kind of a feeling for her all the way through high school. And graduation came, and I went off to college. And she got married. And so it would seem at least that she was certainly well out of my life. Well, the years passed, and about 15 years later, I was living in Phoenix at that time, teaching at Phoenix College. And I went to a movie, and as I was standing in line, somebody said, John, and I turned around, and it was a high school classmate. Not in, but it was a high school classmate. And I hadn't seen this classmate for some time, in fact, for the same period of time, roughly about 15 years. And you know what you do at times like that, don't you? What do you do? Where's Joe? Where's Fred? Have you seen Chuck? What's he doing now? Have you seen Ann Chapman? What's she doing now? And the response came, well, she's divorced and living in Spokane, Washington. Oh. And so I sat down and I wrote a letter. And 2 years later, we were married. Now, when I share that with my classes, half of the girls get starry-eyed right at that moment, just sort of look off into space. Now, when we got married, we were up at the altar together, and the minister made an interesting statement. He said, why don't we all come up here and get married together? And what he meant by that was that I was not only marrying Anne, I was marrying her 5 children as well. Now, when I make that statement to my classes, the other half of the girls get starry-eyed at that point. Somebody asked me, I shared that story at this conference I was doing in San Francisco, and somebody said, what do the boys do at that time? And I think they get a look of terror on their face. I think that's probably the best answer. Anyway, I wound up being the father, the instant father of quintuplets. And they ranged in age from daughters who were 5 and 7 to sons who were 14, 15, and 16. And from that moment on, I want you to know my life would never be the same again. Now, I've noticed that whenever I do share that, and I make that kind of a comment, that my life was changed or whatever, I notice there's a sense of humor or laughter that comes from that. But what happened for me was that the whole direction of my life was about to change. And I want to talk to you about how that change came about. And then ultimately, I will get to a definite point. I think you'll see the point. As I said, my life would never be the same. Now, within 6 months after the wedding, Ann and I discovered that our 3 sons, 14, 15, 16, were all very deeply into the drug scene. And that was something that, as a new father, I didn't know whether I, you know, how prepared I was to deal with that. But they were all three very deeply involved with the drug scene. Now, a year later, or by a year later, I was really very, very scared. And so was my wife. We were afraid to leave our kids at home, the little ones, because we didn't know what shape the boys might be in or their friends might be in. And that was really a terrifying kind of experience. On the other hand, where we didn't want to leave them there, we didn't want to have friends over anymore because we really felt like prisoners in our own home. We didn't know what shape our sons might come into the house or their friends might come in. And that we found to be a very terrifying kind of thing and a very distressing one. And so 2 years after the wedding, the stress level or the tension level in our home had reached such a point that, as Ann and I talked about it, we realized that we were talking about either having a family or not having a family. It was a matter that it was really the kids or us, as we were looking at it, or at least the boys or us. What do we do? And so after deciding what our role as parents was, I confronted the oldest son out in the front yard one morning. And I said, Ron, we need to let you know, or I need to let you know, that your mother and I have talked, and we have recognized that you have some problems with drugs, and we also know that your behavior is causing us some problems, and the problems that are ours, we have to do something about. And the problems that are yours, you're the only one who can do anything about that. And so at this point, you're at a crossroads because you have a choice. You can come out of the drug scene entirely, and we will support you in that, get you into a drug rehab program, but there's no in-between there. You have to come out entirely, and we'll support you in that. Or you can go back to Spokane, where your drug supply is good, and go up there and blow your mind. Now, he paused for a moment. He said, I'm going back to Spokane. I said, fine. This envelope has your bus ticket, and it has a $50 cashier's check, and that will pay for your food until you can get up to Spokane where your friends are and your drug supply is good. And I want you to know, my heart fluttered as I handed him that check. And so, well, can I think about it? I said, sure, you have till 3 o'clock in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I went to his room, said, what's your decision? He said, I'll go into the drug rehab program. Now, we were relieved. I think as parents, many of you, I think you can put yourselves into the position of how relieved would you be under those circumstances. So, he's doing it. Now, everything was fine until about 6 months later, when the director of that program came to our home, had Ron with him, and said, we encourage you to get Ron onto the psychiatric ward of the mental hospital. And I'd urge that you do that today. Well, we did that immediately. Then we went back home. Ron was there for a month. We went down for the various sessions and so forth with him. Then he came home for a month. And things were okay again, but he regressed. And it finally, after that month, we decided, well, maybe Ron needs to go back. And I asked him if he wanted to go back to the hospital. He said, yes, he did. And it was about that point that I really panicked. Because here was our number one son on the mental ward of a hospital. And here we were, parents of four more children, and beyond that, we had added the fifth, or actually the sixth for the family. And I was saying to myself, how on earth can I stop this from happening, this terrible thing from happening, to the rest of my family? And so I picked up the telephone one morning, called the Mental Health Association, and said, will you please send me everything you've got on the prevention of mental emotional illness? The young lady put me on hold, came back on the line, said, I'm sorry, we don't have anything. All right, thank you. She said, may I give you the state office number? So I called the state office. I asked that same question. Will you please send me everything that you've got on the prevention of mental emotional illness? And the young lady put me on hold, came back on the line, said, I'm sorry, we don't have anything. But the national office does put out one pamphlet. May I send it to, send for it for you? I said, well, thanks, but no thanks. Now, it was at that point that I made a discovery. I don't know if any of the rest of you have made that discovery, but I made a real discovery. And the discovery that I made was one that was this, that we do not have, in the United States of America, we do not have a mental health system. What we have is a mental illness system. In other words, it's a system that, in order to take advantage of it, you must become ill. And I, as I said, I was at a conference, and the keynote speaker was a Dr. Lucas, several weeks ago. Dr. Lucas was from Germany, and she made an interesting observation. She said, we do not have it now, either a psychology of the victim, nor do we have a psychology of prevention. In other words, we don't have any way of dealing with that. Now, I've become aware today of a program, I believe in Everett, right, where some victims are being taken care of. But at least we don't have that in terms of prevention. Now, why all the emphasis on cure? Well, because right now, I don't know if you're aware of it, but we are experiencing in this land of ours a tremendous flood of people who are going into therapy.
Got a little focus there, Jeff.
Sure, let me do what I can here. In fact, will that do it?
That'll do it.
Okay, good, thank you. So, anyway, we're experiencing this kind of a flood that is going into therapy right now, and somewhere along the line we need some sort of a dam to be built. I'd like to share with you the kind of dam that we have right now. Some of these figures, some of you may be acquainted with them, some of you may be disturbed by them, but I want you to know that they're the most current information I could get. I obtained these probably about 3 months ago. George Albee testified before our Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee just last year. And he was representing the American Psychological Association, and he was representing the Association for the Advancement of Psychology, those two groups. And Dr. Albee informed the committee that right now we have 45,000 practicing psychiatrists and psychologists in the United States, 45,000 of them. Now, of that number, over half of them are located in the five states that you see marked up there. Over half of them are there. California, Illinois, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, the District of Columbia, and New York. Now, two-thirds of our counties in America, think about that. I don't know what county you live in, but two-thirds of our counties in America have no mental health professional at all. Two-thirds of our counties. Now, one fascinating statistic that Albee reported, think about this, what the implications of it are right now, is that right now there have been more psychiatrists who have died in the last several years than there have been people entering the field of psychiatry. Do you see what I'm saying with that? Psychiatry as a field is literally dying out in America. Now that for me was pretty striking. Now, that's the extent of the dam that we now have to hold back that flood that I was talking about. Now, all of this that I've been sharing with you in terms of our family sort of occurred right in the early 70s. And it was 1974 that I really got wrapped up in this business of prevention when I realized that nobody else was doing it. And in 1974, I want to share the figure that I was sharing with people at that time. I would go out to groups like this, I'd be talking, and I would let them know that 1 in 10 of us would require professional psychiatric care during our lifetimes, 1 in 10. And I would also share the figure from that time that 1 in 4 families would experience the emotional illness of a loved one. Now, I want to give you an aside here of something that happened. One of the times that we took Ron to the hospital, we went to a family group there. And as we were leaving, there was another set of parents, I don't know what the correct word, you know, or pair of parents, whatever, who were standing outside the door. And this set of parents, the wife turned to us and said, what are you telling people about where your son is? And my wife said, well, we're telling them that he is at St. Joseph's Psychiatric Ward. You are? And I said, well, why not? And she said, oh, we couldn't do that. Now, we're so thankful. Now, what I want you to appreciate here is the husband of this pair was a major, I think, a vice presidential level of AT&T. You know, so, and this woman, his wife, was saying, oh, we couldn't share that kind of information. We're so thankful that we moved out here to Arizona from New York, because that way we don't have to tell the family. And I guess what I'm sharing there is that that couple did not realize what those figures were at that time, 1 in 4. That's a very common kind of thing to have happen in a home, to have that kind of emotional illness. But they didn't want to talk about it, and they never found out about it, how others were. I think one of the final areas I want to share with you here is that if we were to take, remember I talked about the 45,000? If we were to take all of the psychiatrists and the psychologists right now and have them treat only the hardcore emotionally ill, and what you need to know is that where that figure was 1 in 10 before, it in the last 10 years has moved to 1 in 7 who are emotionally ill hardcore. Now, if we were to take all of our mental health professionals, have them treat only the hardcore themselves would receive only 72 minutes of therapy per year. Now think about that in terms of that flood that I was talking about. And one last sort of final statistic about all of that is that in the next 20 years, the projections are that it will increase by 20%. 20%. And so you can see what we have in terms of that flood. Now, in the early 1970s, a book came out that I like very much. Let me refer you to it if you haven't heard of it already. It's a book by Dorothy Corkle Briggs, and it's on your child's self-esteem. It's a very good book. But that particular book, at the very beginning of it, she shares an interesting study that was done in New York, where 175,000 people were, if you will, tested. 175,000 people. Think of all those numbers. And out of that number, she found that, well, here's a statement. One study of 175,000 people in New York City showed that only 18.5% were free of symptoms of mental illness. Now, I've had people say to me, you've never lived in New York, or you'd understand that. But think about that. 18.5% are free of mental illness. Now, let me take your attention back to this area here. And notice that originally I was talking about the hardcore emotionally ill. Let's put them on one side of a continuum, one end of it. And we have 15% then, or 1 in 7, hardcore emotionally ill. Let's take the other end of the continuum, and what do we have over there? We have 18.5% who are free of symptoms, and I guess that's going off the chart. But
it isn't very clear right now.
Okay.
Let me see if I can do it.
That's good enough.
There you go.
Okay, let's just adjust it here. How's that?
That's it.
All right. Now, we have that 18% who are free of symptoms. Now, if you'll notice, there's another group. And the group there is what would be described as the mid-range. So let's go back. Those who are free of symptoms, as a college professor, I'd say, hey, these people get A's in mental health. Okay? The other group, still further back, the hardcore, are the ones who are flunking mental health. Okay? But there is then, if we can go past that again, that mid-range of about 67% who are, remember, they're not in the healthy group. But what I want you to appreciate is they are at the norm. These are the normal people. They're not the healthy ones. They're the normal ones. And I want you to appreciate, too, that these are not fixed percentages. You know, we don't have everybody at one end and everybody at the other end, but there's mobility back and forth. And that's an important point to realize. Now, who is in the mid-range? And I want you to think about these for a moment. These people are the victims of a million divorces a year in America. Every year, 2 million husbands and wives, and their several million children, enter into the pain of divorce or experience that pain. Now, these are people in the mid-range. They're not, you know, I'm not saying, you know, they're hardcore mentally ill, obviously not. But they're experiencing pain at that particular point. Other group for you to be aware of is that this mid-range includes the spouses and the estimated 15 million children of alcohol and drug addicts. And half of these children are going to become alcoholics themselves. They are now in the mid-range. They will eventually wind up in the hardcore. And the mid-range includes the families and the friends of thousands of known suicide victims. And these are the people who are hurting during that, or hurting during the period of grief, at the loss of a wife, a husband, a child, a parent. They're hurting during that time. They're in the mid-range, and that's common. Now, again, certainly there's overlap, but the point that I was making with the title of this speech, or a presentation, if you will, is that it really is not normal for people to be healthy in America. Because health is over on that other end. And all of us want to be in that area. And most of us have been in that area for a good share of our lives. But what does this all have to do with us? In 1980, the Gallup organization, you know the Gallup poll, asked a question of the people, you know, their representative sample. And I'd like to ask that same question of you right now. And I'd like to have you use that piece of paper that you were handed earlier. And I'd like to have you write it down. Here's the question that the Gallup organization asked. Where do you go for help with a family problem? Where do you go for help with a family problem? Now, I'd like you to list, if you will, five places where you go, if you can, five places where you go when you have a family problem. Anybody need more time or want more time? Okay, now I'd like to have you, if you will, simply compare your answers, as you've either thought about them or written them down, with the results of that Gallup organization poll. Because this is where Americans go in order, if you will, in order of importance at least, or frequency. First place we go as Americans is to another family member. Did a lot of you get that? Okay. So we go to somebody else in our family when we're hurting or we want to deal with that problem. The second place we go is to a friend. Okay? So you may have written somebody's name down there, whatever. So we go to a friend, secondly. This really did my heart good. I may not be a minister, but it still did my heart good. Because the third place that we go is to the Bible. People turn to the Bible for guidance or whatever. And the fourth place they go is to a member of the clergy. Talk it over with their pastor. May have been that they didn't find that answer in the Bible, and so they like more guidance. The fifth place we as Americans go is to our doctor. Sixth, we go to books other than the Bible. And this is probably one of the reasons the self-help books do so well. The seventh place we go is to a professional counselor. And the last place we go is to an attorney. Now, as you think about that, and realize, you know, virtually the shortage that we have of counselors and professional helpers, we don't want to go to them anyway. They're way, way down on our list. We don't expect help from them. We only go to them when our family doesn't help us, when our friends don't help us, and we're not finding other help. On down the line, they're our last ditch resort for getting some help. I think that's really striking. Because what I'm sharing with you now, we're going to be talking about human relations kinds of things over this next week. And what this suggests to me is, when we are dealing with what I look on as being the real dam against mental illness even occurring or emotional illness occurring, I'm talking about the dam of communication then. Because you and I are the only ones who can ever erect a dam that's going to help our loved ones, our family, our friends, to prevent them from eventually needing therapy. And as I said before, we have a mental illness, not a mental health system. So our loved ones are going to come to us first. But let me share this with you. The average family with children in America spends 14 and a half minutes in interpersonal communication with those children a day. 14 and a half minutes. 12 of those minutes are typically spent on such things as, hey mom, what's for dinner? Hey dad, can I use the car? And that leaves only 2 minutes then left for the more important of questions of who are you and how are you doing in this world? So one of the things that really becomes necessary is for us as family members then is to be taking a look at that area of communication as prevention. Now one of the things that was sort of interesting for me was thinking back to 1974 when I realized that mental health agencies weren't dealing with it. I started looking at whose job is it to work with prevention. And I realized at that point that it had to do with what a mental health worker does and does not do. One of the things I was aware of was that mental health workers did not get into the heads of people and move the things around inside their head and change those processes to make people healthy again. What I discovered from a man by the name of Jürgen Rusch, a social psychiatrist, this statement is from him. He says the psychiatrist's procedures are to improve the processes of communication of their patients. In other words, that's what a psychiatrist does. In large measure, is to work with communication, not with things inside the head. So, anyway, I realized that was sort of the job of my own field, and as a result of that, I wound up then having a mission myself, and that mission had to be one of introducing people to communication skills necessary for mental health. Now, as a college professor, it may seem kind of strange to you that I use that word up there, introduce, but it really isn't, because I want to tell you about just a few of my students. One of the students I'd like to share some information about is a young lady that I call Karen. Well, in fact, one of the reasons I call her that is because that's her name. And Karen had a rather interesting childhood. She came just to talk with me. I make it a point in my classes, I'll say, hey, if you ever need a listener, and you don't have your listener around, for goodness sakes, call me. Come on over and we'll talk. And Karen was a young lady who, when she was in the seventh grade, her dad fell in love with a younger woman. And he divorced Karen's mother, married the younger woman, and he started a brand new family. And Karen remained with her mother, with the rest of the children of the family. Now, what I ask you now is, what has Karen learned about human relationships and about how men and women relate to one another? What has she learned about healthy relationships? Because you see, Karen has never seen up close a healthy relationship between a man and a woman. What has she learned? Now, what I want to stress for you is that Karen, or what she's experienced, is normal in America. She is simply one of a million child victims a year of divorce. Those other children have not seen that. She's normal. I want you to appreciate how normal she really is. There's another young lady, well, let me also mention here too, that currently half of America's children will spend at least a portion of their childhood in one-parent families. What do you learn about healthy relationships, man and woman, in one-parent families? You say they've never had that chance to learn. That's why I said we have to introduce. I want to share another young lady. This is Beth. She is also, coincidentally, in Karen's class. Beth came to me one day, and she said, well, when she came in, no, just totally forlorn. I have never seen a more forlorn face on anyone in my life. And she came in, she sat down, didn't say a word, and I just decided to wait her out. And she finally began, and she said, I don't know where to begin. I ended fall quarter pregnant. I started winter quarter with an abortion. And they promised me it wouldn't hurt. And it hurts. Now, tragic? Yes. Hurt desperately. Normal? Yes. You see, when one-third of the pregnancies in the United States are terminated in an abortion, Beth is normal. And we have to appreciate and recognize that fact. The last young lady I want to tell you about, it's coincidental that these are all ladies. I've had a number of fellows come and talk to me too. The last one was a young lady, Donna. One day she came to class, or came to my office, and in my classes we do a lot of things at the very beginning of the term that are sort of experiential kinds of things, getting acquainted with each other and with the class content and so forth, just sort of get fun activities. And Donna came to my class one day, or my office one day, about the third week into the term, and she said, "I used to love coming to your class, but it's not fun anymore." Now, the reason it wasn't fun for Donna was because I was sharing in my class many of the same things I've just shared with you now. I was sharing statistics about mental health, emotional health, about drug addiction, all that sort of thing. Beyond that, though, I was sharing, basically those things and some of the family stories. And what was happening with Donna was that she was relating with everything I was talking about. Because she, in her early years, she was the oldest child in the family. In her early years, her mom and dad divorced. Her mom didn't want to take responsibility for the kids. Her dad didn't want to take responsibility for the kids. Both of them remarried other people. And the kids, the marriage split and the kids fell out the bottom. And Donna was just one of them. Now think back to those other figures I've shared with you. And I think you'll realize then that what Donna experienced, again, realizing, simply that what she'd experienced and what all these others have been experiencing is normal, and they're at the norm. And so, as I see it, it's our responsibility, you know, as parents, grandparents, however, to really help people and the people we love not to conform to the norm. Because normal people out there ain't healthy. That's very different. And it's our responsibility to let those people that we love know what health is like, not what normalcy is like. And in order to do that, there are a couple things that we need to do. The first one is that we have to explain to those people and let them know that love is a verb. And that's what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow. And the second thing is one of letting them know that mentally healthy people are people who have purpose in their lives and direction in their lives. And I'd like to, I was going to have you at this point sort of get into groups and share what the purpose is that you've seen for your life over the years, and as you see it in the years ahead. With this number of people, I'm not going to do that. But I would let me, at this point, pause, if you will, and, in fact, let me stop and deal with any questions you have or any observations you have. I'm sure in a group of this size, with this experience, I'm sure there's a lot that could be added.
What happened to the boy?
Our son?
Yeah.
He right now is in Spokane, Washington. He came out of the hospital. The background of our boys, by the way, was that their father was alcoholic, and so at this point we're going to see this one now in Washington. He's in Spokane, Washington now. He's been having some difficulties with alcohol. We're told that he has it more in tow. I hope so. But anyway.
The other boys, did they go in the drug scene?
The other boys are, we have one in Colorado now who's been working in the oil fields and so forth there. He has pretty well cleaned up his act. We have one who's very much involved in AA, and he's really cleaned up his act. He'll be graduating in, oh, I hate to tell you this, he's going to graduate in communication from Mississippi State. So.